Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, your weekly podcast about how there's sometimes cool people who did cool stuff, like me. I'm the host. I'm Margaret Killjoy. And I was going to segue into introducing Bridget Todd, who's the host of There Are No Girls on the Internet. But instead, I messed it up. But hi, Bridget. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. You do plenty of cool stuff. That's all you do is cool stuff.
All I do is read history books, but I kind of like it, so I'm not complaining about my job. I got the best one I think anyone on this earth has. And the person who helps me have that job is my producer, Sophie. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Magpie.
Thanks for producing my podcast.
Oh, that's a privilege.
We also have an audio engineer named Daniel. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. And this is part two in a two-parter about Lord Byron and Ada Lovelace. And it was meant to mostly be about Ada Lovelace. And then I spent an entire episode talking about the archetypical, the original fuckboy, her father, Lord Byron. Usually I say you can't listen to part two without listening to part one. You could probably listen to part two today. But I actually think it's really useful to understand where Ada is coming from because she's really into her dad. That's my disclaimer. So yeah, in part one, we talked about an agent of chaos sent straight from hell to homewreck or a misunderstood fuckboy. In part two, we're going to talk about his daughter, Ada, the actual reason we're doing these episodes, the person who qualifies as a cool person doing cool stuff. Ada Lovelace, who was not born Ada Lovelace, was born in 1815, right before her mom left her dad. Her mother, Lady Byron, was a dedicated reform activist, and I kind of assumed that this was a pretty milquetoast and uninteresting thing when I read that. I'm like, oh, a dedicated reform activist. That just sounds like some rich lady who wants to feel better or whatever. She was part of the group that ended slavery in the British Empire and freed 800,000 people.
So she was a cool person who, or a person who was doing cool stuff on her own, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And she fought for prison reform. I wish I knew a little bit more about what that meant, but that's still great, especially since England at the time was like, let's just hang everyone, right? And she fought for the abolition of slavery. She was one of the very few women involved very actively in the British abolitionist movement because the men wouldn't let women be involved because men. And so she was one of like three or so women at the 1840 World Anti-Slavery Convention. This was held in England. It was about 200 Brits, 50 Americans, and a few other random folks. Almost all of them are white men. There's a handful of white women and a handful of black men, is the best I can figure. I'm not aware of black women being invited since women weren't invited at all, and it was almost an afterthought. Whatever. I'm not impressed by the politics of this particular group around identity issues.
But, not intersectional.
Right. However, this convention came out of a movement that had just managed to abolish slavery in the British Empire in 1834, which freed 800,000 people, like I mentioned. The main group behind that, I never would have thought would have done anything worthwhile based on their name. Usually the cool groups have like the League of something or whatever, right? This was the Society for the Mitigation and Gradual Abolition of Slavery Throughout the British Dominions.
Who came up with that name? That was not a good name.
No, but it worked. I only read so much. Every now and then I read about the abolitionist movement in the UK, but I don't know as much about it as I know about the abolitionist movement in the US, right? Okay, that said, you know how the British Empire can kind of take anything that sounds good and make it bad? Abolish slavery was the rallying cry that was used in the scramble for Africa, that where like they colonized Africa and killed fuck tons of people and set the continent up for a pretty economically terrible 20th and 21st century. Because empire can make anything that's good into a bad thing.
That's a just get that like tattooed or like put on a shirt.
I know.
Worth to live by.
So they had this conference, right? This is before this is 40 years before the Scramble for Africa really kicks off. So I can't say that these people were responsible for that. They were in the middle of doing something actually good. The non-inclusion of women at this conference was on purpose. It was for men only. The larger faction, there was like a big fight about whether or not women should be included, and the larger faction won. And then three women showed up anyhow, and including Lady Byron. And they had some supporters from within the convention who forced their inclusion. The same faction that fought for the inclusion of women actually made an effort to bring, oh, I don't know, black people from America where slavery was a big problem. Including this guy who is just really fucking cool. I never really read about him before. Charles Lennox Remond. He is credited as the first black public speaker talking about abolition in the United States.
Oh, wow. I hadn't heard of him either.
Yeah, he wasn't a minor figure at the time, but he wasn't like the wildest militant. He was born free, so he doesn't have the cool escape story. Like, don't get me wrong, the escape stories are fucking cool. But like, he just was like putting in the work as an orator and as an organizer. And he was the kid of two hairdressers. And one of his big things that he fought for successfully was that he organized that basically like free black people would leave en masse any church that didn't let them sit as equals at the communion table. And when he made it to England for this convention, all the women were denied entry. So he protested and walked out alongside of them. He had just traveled across the fucking ocean to come to this thing that was like for freeing black people. And he was like, well, I'm intersectional. Fuck all that.
Yeah, I mean, I was joking earlier about how the group wasn't intersectional, but it's not like there weren't people who were down with intersectionality back then.
Yeah, and it's something that's come up a bunch of times. Like, when you look at, for good reason, people are critical of the early feminist movement for being racist, right? And people look at some of the abolitionist movement and see the exclusion of women or whatever. But the thing that I actually run across way more is people who cared about both, saw them as connected, and fought for both. Like, they're just not as talked about. I mean, especially because, like, once rich people feminism kicks in and the suffragettes kind of, there's some big racism problems and they're worth paying attention to, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so Charles, he's probably the most uncomplicatedly cool person in this week's episode. He helped recruit black soldiers to the Union Army. After the war, he worked as a street lamp inspector, a clerk, and then ended his life as a farmer. So he's just a working class kid of hairdressers who, yeah.
Do we know if he was like sending his pubic hair to people and like sleeping with everyone's partners and any of that?
See, I'm not aware of that. And so that's part of like, I'm like, maybe he's the uncomplicated character because I didn't read a whole book about him, right? You know, because like everyone...
He did all that and just didn't write it down.
Yeah, exactly. He was like, oh man, you wouldn't believe what I got up to in England. You know, whatever, as long as everyone's into it, I don't care. And Frederick Douglass went on to name one of his sons after this guy. Charles Remond Douglass was the first black man to join the Union Army. And Charles Remond Douglass, the Douglass's kid, was actually too sick to actually wind up marching on the Confederacy, but did a lot of work and was... That's still a pretty fucking cool thing to get to say you did, you know? So, and one of the reasons I think about this is that I'm like, I'm about to talk about the origin of computers and all this stuff. And Instead of thinking of history as this distinct, unrelated things, you need your big red yarn board. The same guy who stands up for Luddites also fought for Greek independence against the Ottomans and was married to a British woman who was directly involved in the abolition of slavery in both the UK and the US. Like, and that's where computer software comes from, you know?
Yeah, I love how you put that because it's so easy. I don't think anybody who listens to this pod thinks this way, but it's very easy to think of history as this thing that happened forever ago that was like very distinct, right? And so like, we'll put Black history in one bucket or like women's history in another bucket or like, you know, gender studies or sexuality in another bucket. And those, and there's this idea that those things are not bleeding over and intersecting and having connections. And then something else like technology, that's in a completely separate realm. And it's like, no, it's all mixed in. It's all history. It's all this like very complex, you know, patchwork of things that happened and intersected.
Yeah. My Google history is just full of like person's name, religious beliefs, person's names, political views, person's name, feminism, person's name, abolitionist, just to see what comes up, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's always more to people, because people want to have this one-dimensional view of everyone, you know? Lady Byron also set up England's first cooperative school, basically socialist education. I don't know whether she identified as a socialist or not, but one of the people whose work she was using to set up this cooperative school was outspokenly a socialist. And the specific point of it, one of the things that I feel like I don't quite understand about England is a weird thing, you know, I mean, so is America. Like, white American society is evil too. I'm not trying to be like, oh, those English, they're the only bad people. But the like educational system there was absolutely horrific in terms of bullying kids, forcing them into a fearful environment in which they are hyper competitive of each other, right? And that, I mean, that causes the British Empire on some level, right? It's a chicken and egg problem, but it's like this culture of fear and domination. And so Lady Byron tries to stop it by setting up a cooperative school. Her quote about this is about talking about how students should be treated is that fear makes slaves and the love of distinction leads to bullying and the aggressive passions encouraged in England's elite public school systems.
That's so progressive to be seeing the ways that competition and I guess like the desire to be distinct, I guess how she put it, how that would fuel all these ugly things in society. I can't imagine that was like well received at the time.
I know. And the school managed to last about 80 years. They taught the basics. They taught kids how to garden and track their income and shit also, in addition to like, you know, teaching literature and math and all these things. So they actually like taught practical life skills.
Like useful stuff that we should have all learned in school.
Yeah, exactly. And eventually it shut down in 1917, but it lasted like 80 years. And yeah, like people kind of, I think there was a little bit, the best I can tell, I only read so much about her, but I read a decent bit about her. As best as I can tell, people were like, oh, those wacky hippies doing their wacky hippie thing. You know, probably there was a lot of culture war stuff about like, no, it's the fighting pits of educational system that makes England the world power we are, you know? So Ada's mother was pretty cool, at least politically. She used to take Ada around on tours of like textile mills to look at the conditions that workers were in, which is probably, if you are raised a noble, you should probably have to go see how the other half lives, you know? And anything that Lady Byron was working on was willing to hire Black Americans escaping slavery. And that, I think, was a pretty big deal that a lot of people in England were like not okay with. And she was like, I don't care, we're going to do it. And I'm annoyed that she's mostly remembered as the wife of Lord Byron.
Because all of these cool things, like she was doing cool stuff on her own.
Yeah. Not as like sexy, you know, she just kind of was like fairly polite and religious and just tried to make the world better, you know. She stayed in love with her husband after their separation because she viewed his problems as madness, right? Not as a character flaw. And she was also constantly trying to save his soul from damnation. He's like in Greece and stuff. And she's like writing letters being like, hey, you gonna repent? Like, you know, that like meme format that's like something, something today. Hey, babe, like, you want to do this today? You
know, yeah.
Basically just texting him constantly being like, what's up? You want to accept Jesus Christ, your personal Lord and Savior today? This probably didn't endear her to him. But as for how she raised Ada, this is messier. She seems like maybe not the best mom. Now, to be clear, single moms get way more flack than they should. And Lord Byron certainly didn't do a very good job of fathering her. On the other hand, she didn't let Lord Byron have anything to do with their kid, as far as I can tell. And basically, Lady Byron was like, no matter what, I'm going to make sure my kid does not end up a wild libertine like her father. Her father dies when Ada is 8. And the way that she set about to do this was to not let her have an imagination. This is the way it gets described. Downplayed or outright forbade teaching poetry and shit like that. No creativity, all STEM. Except, according to other sources, did teach a lot of like music. So it might have just been a specific like no poetry, right?
Well, I mean, it makes sense if she was like, I don't want my daughter to end up like her libertine poet dad. No poetry in this house. But
yeah.
I was going to say something, though. I do think like the idea of STEM only. I know a lot of people who think that the only thing worth studying, if you're interested in tech or you have aspirations to be in tech, the only thing worth studying is a hard science or a STEM, and that humanities, poetry, music, gender studies, literature, all of that is just fluff, and the only thing that matters is a hard tech. And those people, I feel like they, even if they are like gifted engineers or something, mm-hmm. I think that they might have trouble understanding what it is that people who are going to go on to use the technology that you build are using it for, which is often culture or, you know, something that is not a hard tech. And so I guess I would say, like, I say that to say that you need all the things to be a well-rounded technologist. I don't like it when people poo-poo the humanities because they're like only focusing on programming or whatever. I think it's a really myopic way of seeing technology.
No, totally. And that's Ada's gift to computing and technology, is that it's the reason that she's seen as so important, or is so important, is that she bridged the world between math and creativity. And this became like her whole fucking thing, because she was both her parents' kid, you know? Like, exactly everything that you're saying about it is the thing that she was about, and like why I got really excited about her as I was reading all this stuff, you know? And so it didn't work, this attempt to stifle the creative spirit, which might be an unkind reading of Lady Byron. It's hard to tell. Everyone who's writing these things feels really strongly about Lord Byron. No one gives a shit about Ada. No one gives a shit about Lady Byron. Everyone either fucking loves or hates Lord Byron. So everything revolves around him. And I know that some of it does, and I had to start with him, but it's so hard to tell. It's so hard to tell exactly, because some of the people saying, oh, she was a terrible mother, are Byron apologists, or Lord Byron apologists. Anyway, there are definitely versions where the mother's pretty monstrous. She's a rich kid, so she has all these private tutors and shit, right? Apparently any of them, again, according to this reading, any of them got too close emotionally to Ada were fired. So she's like not allowed to care about her teachers or have like affection. And there's a portrait of her dad, Lord Byron, hanging in her grandmother's house, but she's not allowed to see it. It is behind green velvet curtains. Like, what a way to make a kid obsessed with their dad.
Yeah, that's, I mean, first of all, that's like, put anything behind big velvet green curtains and tell a child, you must never look behind these curtains. Of course they're going to like fixate on what's behind those curtains.
I know.
Of course.
I know. What's your obsession with the forbidden box of forbiddenness, kid?
Why can't you just forget about the forbidden box of forbiddenness?
Yeah. So when she's 11 and her father is like safely dead in the ground, her mother takes her on tour around Europe for a year, because that's like a normal rich people thing to do. But they couldn't do it when she was younger because they didn't want to accidentally run into Lord Byron. Young Ada came back with her imagination on fire. She was like, holy shit, there's a world out there. And she became obsessed with trying to invent a flying machine. She studied birds. She tried to get every book she could about birds so that she could build a steam-powered ornithopter. I don't think the word ornithopter existed yet, but this is what she wanted to build. This is before people figured out fixed-wing aircraft. And so everyone's into ornithopters, which are like the flyy ones. I guess everyone knows what it is now because Dune's out. But some of us just have a terrible background in steampunk, and so I've known about this for a long time. And it makes sense that people thought about flapping wings instead of fixed-wing aircraft, right? Because if you look around and you see the stuff that's flying, it flaps its wings, you know? So she spends years trying to invent this thing. It wasn't until the 1870s that the first ornithopters were built, and they used rubber bands. And so, like, rubber kind of successfully invented the ornithopter to some degree. So she's into this shit. She is the world's first steampunk, I would argue. Much like our sponsor, subcultures that seem promising and have some good elements, but also some cringy stuff. Are we sponsored by that?
Are you sponsored by big top hat and goggles?
Oh, no. Well, it's better than a pith helmet. I guess anything's better than a pith helmet. Steampunk was the greatest subcultural betrayal of my life. I was like, what? We're all obsessed with punk and also where the Industrial Revolution and colonization really got going and started destroying the world. And so we're really interested in the people who are perfectly positioned to fight against it. And we're making alliances across the world to destroy empire. And then I went to the conventions and it was all top hats and goggles. And I was like, I think I'm at the wrong convention. Anyway, maybe your next big disappointment is here in these ads.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Mother's Day is coming, and mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
So, we're back, and Ada Lovelace is back from Europe and decides to do the one thing that you should not do in the 19th century, which is get sick. She is bedridden for about 3 years. Some folks, of course, chalk it up to psychosomatic stuff, like, oh, she has hysteria, she's just stressed, why doesn't she try yoga? You know, girls just do that sometimes. It was probably measles and encephalitis, which I had to look it up. It's inflammation of the brain.
Oh my God, my roommate got that from a hot tub at Beach Week when we were in college.
Oh, fuck.
It was
God.
Like crazy, yeah.
The wages of sin.
Yes.
That's terrible. She all right?
Oh, she was fine, but like you just needed, I mean, luckily this happened in like
Oh, the 21st century.
Yeah, 2004, and not back when Ada was living. But yeah, she just had to get antibiotics and it ruined Beach Week, but she was fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, Ada spent 3 years lying in bed.
A little different.
From like roughly 13 to 16 or so. She gets better, but she's never going to be in the most robust health at any point in her life. And she goes off to London to join that bullshit society of 5,000 rich assholes who run the world. She is presented at court and meets the king and all that shit. And the whole, like her whole life, she's a little bit like, she doesn't really play this game that much. She's like dresses as an intellectual instead of dressing as like a proper lady or whatever, because she's cool. I mean, dressing as a proper lady is cool too, but it's also cool when you flout all of that. On June 5th, 1833, she's 17 years old. She meets the man who will change her life forever and cement her place in history. And thank God this is not a romantic story. She meets the 41-year-old Charles Babbage, who is generally credited as inventing the first computer. Obviously, it's more or less true, actually.
Wait, did you ever go to the store Babbage's in the mall when you were a kid?
Oh my God, I did. And I would buy video games that on 3.25-inch floppy disks. I loved that. That's why I know who Charles Babbage is. He's been like
same.
A figure in my life. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, no, I actually thought about including that in the script and I was like, oh, it's just going to date me.
I know. People are like, what are they talking about? Like, we're old, y'all. Like, that's like where you like got your janky ass video games while your mom was shopping at Talbot's or whatever. You would go to Babbage's.
Yeah. No, this one has a dragon on the cover. I want it so bad. Dragon War. That was my favorite. I don't even remember what. Yeah. My dad was an early adopter and like spent all his spent a lot of money on computers back when that was a hard thing to do. You know, that was like how he chose to spend the little money he had or whatever. So she meets Charles Babbage, and instead of at a mall, it's at a soiree at his house. And some people like to conjecture that they were sleeping together. Usually I am the first person to believe rumors of people fucking in history. I think that they had a platonic intellectual friendship. She meets Charles Babbage at a soiree at his house. He's got these like little automaton toys like everyone does to impress people at the time. I think he built them. He has like a silver lady with a turban on. It's a little wind up toy or whatever, you know. And her mother's nickname is the Princess of Parallelograms. This is what Lord Byron called her to make fun of her, but I think she's just kind of into it. So Ada and her mom are like not impressed by a little automaton. So he's like, oh, you want to see the real shit? And he takes them back to like back of the house. This thing he's been working on, a fucking difference engine, is a mechanical calculator more ambitious than anyone has ever dreamed at this point that I'm aware of. He has a working fragment of it. It is about 2 feet tall. It has 2,000 brass parts, and it is hand cranked. It can do basic math, including exponents, and extract the root of a quadratic equation, which is a math thing that I looked up for this and then was like, yep, that's a math thing. Because I was a computer nerd and not a math nerd. Were you a math nerd?
No, God, not at all.
You dropped out of a PhD for literature.
No. And like, I once had a conversation with somebody where they were like, oh, I did trig in school. What was your math? And I was like, yeah, my math was just called math, honey. I didn't have any of those names.
Yeah. I did real well at a level of math up where I didn't have to pay attention. And so I was like in the like gifted smart math until about pre-calc. And then I was like barely graduated high school because I almost didn't pass pre-calc because I didn't ever learn the tools with which to study because I had undiagnosed ADHD. Because I was so smart. This is going to come up as related to Charles Babbage, actually. And so this 2 foot tall, 2000 part piece of a difference engine is all that will ever be built of his math machines until more than 100 years after his death. The thing about Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace that's so impressive is like what they almost did, what they dreamed up, what they could have done. And more, the more I read, the more I realized if Ada's poor health and Charles, his neurodivergence hadn't gotten in their way, it probably would have done. Like this could have happened. They did manage to have a direct influence on modern computing, but it wasn't a direct lineage. Basically, other people know this better than I do, but their work was kind of rediscovered early on in computing, rather than it being like people like immediately just building off of what they did. So let's talk about Charles Babbage. You heard much about Charles Babbage besides the store?
I knew a little bit about him, but most of my entry point is the store in the mall.
Yeah, fair enough. The like real quick version is he's a cranky old man with ADHD. Charles Babbage was not nobility, but he was rich, which is kind of the same thing. His father was a successful goldsmith and banker. And so young Chuck, no one called him that besides me right now that I'm aware of. He grew up with private tutors and then he went off to Trinity College where Lord Byron had gone.
And Oscar Wilde.
And while he was there, actually young Charles Babbage seems fun. He formed the Analytical Society with some peers, which is what I consider fun, but his other stuff is more directly fun. He was part of the Ghost Club. They were paranormal investigators.
What?
Yeah. They actually, both Ada and especially Charles Babbage, do some interesting like theological science stuff that I'll talk about in a minute. He also either joins or starts a group called the Extractors Club, which is a group of students who swear to help each other escape asylums if any of them are ever declared insane.
Honestly, like, practical?
I know. And just like, that's like a good, that is a green flag. It's a little bit of a red flag, but I'm not actually colorblind, but this would be the kind of thing I'm colorblind on. This would be a red flag and a green flag in a relationship for me.
Like the fact that you think that you might be institutionalized against your will, not great. The fact that you would help, if that happened, you were confirming that you'll help somebody escape, that is nice.
Yeah, exactly. And again, and going back in time and being like, this person's crazy in the following ways is like always fraught. But like, Charles Babbage was ADHD or like had something that I identify with really hard, which was that he was always starting something new. He was always studying some new thing. And he like, his work suffered because instead of finishing projects, he was on to the next one.
Oof. I identify with that. That's a little bit of a direct hit.
Well, the next line of my script is that motherfucker should have just gotten into podcasting because then you can deep dive a new subject every week.
I was going to say, I think somebody should do like a analysis of 8 people who have ADHD and also became podcasters. There's got to be a big overlap.
I know. I was actually worried when I was first got this job and I was like, I was talking to one of my friends and I was like, I'm really good at starting projects. I'm pretty good at seeing projects through, but I always need to be on to the next thing. And my friend was like, every time I talk to you, you are in a 1 month research hole about a different thing. That never changes. The fact that you want to be in a research hole does not change. And I was like, oh, so, and here we are.
Insightful friend.
I know. He was really into math and he was really into astronomy, Charles Babbage. He gave lectures and wrote papers, which is kind of like podcasting, to be honest. And he was supported by his dad and his wife's family because there wasn't a lot of money in this science stuff. And so I want to try this line of work as well. Anyone who is rich and trying to get married and wants to finance weird projects, hit me up. Especially if you're landed nobility, I'm going to change my tune about titles and all that nonsense if you can make me a baroness. Just putting that out there.
Baroness Margaret Killjoy.
Yeah. But probably not actually. I'm really picky. Probably don't actually DM me about this. I was like, oh, I'm going to make this clever joke. And I was like, oh, I'm going to destroy my DMs. So at one point, I wrote in the early 1920s, but I meant the 1820s. He goes to France. And when he's in France, he learns that the French government is pouring a ton of money and energy into math. Not theoretical math, although that's cool too, but they are hiring computers like the job description people who do computing. And if people want to hear more about that, they can go back and listen to me and Bridget talking about that and the black woman who put us on the moon and all that cool shit. And so France is hiring computers to do logarithm and trigonometry tables, which were used for navigation and engineering. So instead of having to sit down and do really complicated math, you can look at the table. Charles saw this and was like, oh, doing stuff for the social good is good, and we should have more of that. Specifically, I want that for astronomy. I wish the British government would hire me to do that. And he also said, quote, I wish to God these tables had been made by steam, because he was just looking at how much work is involved in computing all these things. So he was like, all right, well, I'm going to figure out how to do that. Because at the end of the day, what he was building wasn't a general computer. Certainly not at first. He wanted to build machines that could produce mathematical charts. It was Ada who saw what it could actually really become, but he hadn't met her yet. This is 1823. He meets her 10 years later. She's like seven. She probably still could have figured this out. She was a smart kid. 1823, he convinces the British government to give him a bunch of money, about $2 million in modern dollars, to try and build one of these things. It would have 25,000 moving parts, which eventually he gets down to about 8,000 moving parts. He never finishes it. Instead, he spends his life becoming increasingly bitter and grouchy, and he spends all of his time complaining that the British government doesn't finance the sciences, in particular him, enough. Like, this is another guy that I've met, you know?
Oh, if you are in the sciences, technology, you know this guy. Academia, you know this guy who won't stop complaining about how his stuff never gets funded. You know him.
And he's like, I'm a visionary. And you're like, okay, Chuck. But like, he actually is a visionary. You just don't know it, you know? And he's sort of insufferable. Later, he's going to go to war against street musicians because they keep him awake.
That I'm on board with, actually.
Oh, no. I mean, fair enough. As a former street musician, he is complaining about street musicians at 6 a.m. And I can't imagine, when I was a street musician, I did not live in a life. If I was awake at 6 a.m, it's because I hadn't gotten home yet. You know?
Yeah. Nobody, like 6 a.m. street musicians, that's a different level.
Yeah. Yeah. So in 1824, the year after he gets a bunch of money to work on the difference engine, he takes a job making tables for a life insurance company instead. And honestly, that's a good reminder of what would have happened if he had built the difference engine. It wouldn't have been like, now we're mapping the stars. It would have been like, the British Empire got computers 100 years early and like life insurance gets computers 100 years early. In 1827, he published a table of logarithms that would go on to be reprinted for 100 years. And this is just stuff he did the math of. And so his big famous book is called Table of Logarithms of the Natural Numbers from 1 to 108,000. That's his big book. Also in 1827, his dad died, leaving him about 100,000 pounds sterling, which is about $14 million in modern money. Then his wife died. He also lost 5 of his 8 kids. This man was not having a good time. Rich, yes. Happy, no. There's that study that money buys happiness up to about, like, at the time, it was about $70,000 a year. And then after that, it just levels off. The new number is probably almost twice that. But he also wrote a book with the catchy title, Reflections on the Decline of Science in England and on Some of Its Causes, which was his big, like, why won't the British government give me more money?
Like a whole book about that one complaint.
Basically, but it's actually, I mean, it's like probably true. It argues for more public investment in the sciences and better STEM education, you know? And especially since, like, I actually wonder if that comes out of him not being a noble, right? Because the people who have access to science are rich people. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have to work for a living, you can study, sit around and study things at this time. And so, like, actually trying to teach more people more broadly STEM, like, that's cool. In 1832, he finished a small prototype of his difference engine. In 1833, he shows it to Ada and her mother. Meanwhile, Ada's going with her mom to see the textile mills and the terrible working conditions there. And her takeaway wasn't, these people are being treated terrible. I don't know how she felt about that. Actually, I was really annoyed that I couldn't find out how she felt about that. But certainly part of her takeaway was, these machines are fucking cool. And the history of automation and machinery and therefore computing comes back to textiles, which we talked about on our recent Luddite episodes about the automation of these things was like one of the first things that steam power is being used for. Automation was ruining the lives of workers when it could have been improving their lives, except for this new thing sweeping the country called capitalism. But in the abstract, people are figuring out cool shit that machines can do. And it's a shame that the cool ideas for what those machines can do are the reason that it's this spring was too hot and we've had the hottest year on record for several years in a row. Anyway, it's always in the back of my mind whenever I'm like, because I still think computers and technology are cool, but I'm always like, oh, this thing.
Yeah, it's a love-hate. It's a complicated relationship.
It is. In 1804, there was this machine invented called the Jacquard loom, which used a series of punched cards chained together in a continuous sequence to remember textile patterns for weaving. And I would argue that the first piece of computer art predates the computer by 100 years. Because the inventor of this loom, whose name is Jacquard, imagine that, is he has this portrait woven from silk. And this requires 24,000 punched cards to produce. And this is like a commercially available product. Like it's on order. You have to like, they're made to order. But Charles Babbage, for example, has one of these tapestries. And you could call it a print. It still has humans involved, but it is like a machine that is programmed to make a thing.
Such an interesting perspective.
I find it neat because the thing you're talking about, like STEM and like, oh, what can you do with computers? And they're like, well, the first thing you can do is you can make a portrait of a rich asshole. It's kind of cool, you know? Yeah. It would have been like memes and like, it's like, you know, now it's like whenever someone invents a new instrument, the first thing they do is like play the Mario Brothers theme with it or whatever, you know? I'm like, all right, that's fine. So Ada sees the textile machines and she's really into it. She's also really into math like her mother, and soon she is teaching younger women math and she's corresponding with Babbage about his machines. And then she makes a pretty good call. Rarely when on the show when I talk about someone getting married is it a good call if it's a woman. She marries a wife guy, and this guy is named William Lord King. Lord isn't his middle name. His title is Lord King because King is his last name. Fucking Britain. Soon enough, he gets promoted by someone dying and he becomes the Earl of Lovelace. So Ada gets the name Ada Lovelace, the Countess of Lovelace. And how did him becoming an earl make her a countess? Who knows?
Don't want to know if you do. If you know it, keep it to yourself.
Yeah. It's all a weird soap opera, only in this case, it's a soap opera that instead of entertaining people, kills entire culture and extracts resources from around the world. But her husband is a pretty good guy. He's really supportive of her. He's really into math and science and shit, but he's not as good at it as she is, and he doesn't care. He just supports her in doing it. Like, he leverages his credibility as a nobleman, emphasis on the dash men, to get her into spaces that are closed to women. There's like a, she joins this society for like scientists or whatever, and they have this big library, and she like can't go in and use the books, even though she's a member of the society, because she doesn't have a dick. And that annoys me, and it annoyed her. The other thing about her husband, Mr. the King, he is a huge Lord Byron fanboy. And so is Ada Lovelace. The both of them are obsessed with the poetry of dead rock star dad. And like, one, what are the odds that he turned into like this like perfectly nice husband based on his interests? You know, this is like the person who's like, oh, all of my interests are the following literature, and it's just red flag after red flag, and then like... perfectly sweet man. And I would bet a moderate amount of money that the pair swung together. I wouldn't bet all my money, but that's like my vibe I'm picking up.
So I guess that green curtain to make sure that she never became a libertine poet did not work.
Oh no, she is absolutely, like, that's the thing. Like, she's gambling. Well, we'll talk about what she gets up to. She now is in the prime of her life being a rich bitch. She's just like married up, even though she was already up, you know. She has three kids, so she's busy running the household. I put that in quotes because she is hiring people to do the work of running her household. We'll call this Class Bitterness with Margaret Kiljoy. That's the name of this episode. She spends her time riding horses, playing harp, and studying really complex math and hiring the best mathematicians in the world to tutor her, who are willing to, not just because of the money, but because her dad is famous as hell. And she's really into music, too. She wants to be a professional singer, and her friends are like, you should, like, stick to the harp and math.
Ooh,
man, you're
ouch.
So good at the harp and math. It's important to have honest friends, maybe. Or maybe not, you know? Maybe they should have encouraged her. Meanwhile, her mom, in classic form of good at politics, not the best at being a mom, is controlling as hell, yelling at her about how she handles herself in society, because I think she's kind of being a bit of a libertine. And also how she's like raising her kids and shit. Ada, meanwhile, is gambling on horses, drinking, and I think fucking around. She is her father's daughter. And all the while, she's talking to Babbage about the machines. Much like our sponsor, the extinct store Babbage's, if you build a time machine, you can go back, and I recommend buying anything where you have to get a bunch of floppy disks to install it and then swap out the floppy disks at the end of different scenes, and then sometimes have to go back and forth. Wizardry. You could be playing Wizardry right now from our sponsor, Babbage's.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
And we're back. So Charles Babbage is working on these machines, but he has a problem. Well, his real problem is that everyone he loves is dead and he's sad. But his other problem is that he isn't good at finishing projects. And his ability to be productive and make a world-changing machine is hampered by his inability to finish things. Meanwhile, he's writing books with titles like On the Economy of Machinery and Manufacturers, about how to efficiently run factories. And he starts writing sciencey theology, or what was called natural theology. And this is kind of, there's atheists at this time, right? There's always been atheists, I assume, but there's this thing that's happening now that people are really into science, where people are like, oh, well, like, I don't know, it's like all complicated and God made all the complicated. And it's like kind of interesting. He was potentially the first person to basically suggest that God is a programmer creating a complex system, therefore is responsible for the fact that we now have that thing where some people believe we're all living in a simulation.
I am one of those people.
I can't say it's wrong.
I watched a documentary and I walked away from that documentary thinking it's more likely than not. I know it sounds absurd. I know it sounds I just took a massive bong rip, but like, I do believe it. I believe it.
My equivalent level of wacky belief is quantum immortality. I'm like kind of sold on it.
Ooh, you should do a bonus episode that's just like, Cool Zone team, what's your wackiest but deeply held belief?
Yeah, totally. Totally. Okay, well, so you might like his natural theology. He says that the repeating patterns found all throughout the natural world are evidence of the fact that this is a programmed thing. And that miracles aren't breaking natural laws, but were instead, quote, the exact fulfillment of much more extensive laws than those we suppose to exist.
Oh.
Isn't that kind of like, because as a kid, we'd always be like, if someone believed in ghosts, you'd have to figure out how to reconcile it with science. And the answer is like, well, science doesn't understand it yet.
Right.
Like, that's not I don't disagree with that assessment. You know, it's not specifically my setup of beliefs, but like, it makes sense to me.
It makes sense.
Yeah. And meanwhile, he's like throwing huge soirees that Darwin and Dickens and people like that come to. He ran for office on a Yay Factories and Computers platform, but did not win. he wasn't popular because people thought he squandered all the public money, because he got a lot of money from the government to build a machine and then he didn't. So kind of fair. He didn't finish the difference engine, in part because making it was took too long. And it was also, it wasn't just like him carving the brass pieces. He's like hiring people and working with engineers and stuff, right? But soon he already invented something better than the difference engine. He invented the analytical engine. And this one would use punched cards to store data like the looms did. And just to reiterate that modern computing developed out of art instead of the other way around. This analytical machine would basically be a universal computer. He's still seen it as a way to compute tables and charts and shit, just like more efficiently with like less user intervention, like less programming each individual setup, right? In 1840, he goes to Italy and he gives a lecture about this analytical engine. An Italian army engineer who decades later is going to become a center-right prime minister of Italy is a guy named Luigi, because he's Italian. That actually is his name. And he's into it. And in 1842, he wrote about the analytical engine in French. Ada translated it into English for publication. The original was about 8,000 words or so. She added a ton of shit. Her translation was about 20,000 words because of all the notes. This is her thing. This is the thing that she wrote that cements her in history, which is so wild that it's like a translation of a thing. But that's actually a fairly normal way for people to break into sciences and stuff at the time, is to add notes to existing work by translating it. So while she's writing this, this is the thing that, have you run across the like, oh, Ada didn't really do it, Babbage did all the work?
Oh, yes. Many, many times. That's something that tech bros love to trot out.
Yeah. You know who didn't believe that?
Who?
Charles Babbage. He wrote explicitly about the fact that it was Ada's work.
Take like, that, tech bros.
Yeah, listen to your own fucking hero. She corresponded with him about it all the time. Mail in London was like texting. It was 6 times a day. And so people just like, so she just wrote him and was like, hey, I'm working on this part of it and stuff. And they correspond about it, but it was her ideas. And I rarely say things are like history has a consensus about a thing on this show, because like usually they don't. Like Charles Babbage feels this way, and so does everyone who actually studies it, as best as I can tell.
And like he was there, y'all. He would know.
Yeah. And he's like, I mean, he's supportive of her work, but he's not like the hero of like progressiveness and feminism or something either. But, oh, and then meanwhile, Ada, her dutiful husband, is inking over her pencil. She like, it's like the equivalent of like, he's like typing it up, which is like fucking cool.
Yeah, we don't get to do a lot of, I imagine you don't get to do a lot of stories about the supportive, helpful men in the orbit of a talented woman.
I know, the men quietly in the background. They do come up, and they make me very happy. Like, secretly, my favorite kind of person to cover on the show is a wife guy, which is annoying. It should be the cool wife or the cool unmarried woman. But in some ways, I'm just like, oh, look at the guy. He's so nice.
I mean, not to give unsolicited romantic advice, but somebody once told me that if you are an ambitious woman that and you are going to, like, align yourself with a man, that man can either be an anchor or a springboard. There is no in-between, so choose very wisely.
Yeah, that makes some sense. If people don't support the projects you're doing, it's not worth it.
Not worth it.
And so the thing that Babbage did try to write for this piece, this translation, he wanted to write an anonymous preface about how the government wasn't sponsoring science enough and how they should give more money.
This is like his thing.
And Ada's like, no, I'm good. I don't want that in my book. Which is more evidence of the fact that he didn't fucking, like, she controlled this thing. It was her project. And it comes out, and her dutiful husband is giving away copies to all of his friends, being like, look how fucking cool my wife is. And it's the notes in this in which she basically writes the first computer programs. She writes out hypothetical programs that this computer could be used for. And so there's the, like, you know, is she a diversity inclusion or whatever? Is she overrated? And she's only overrated in the same way that so is Charles Babbage. Neither of them made computers. Both of them thought about computers, you know? Which is kind of cool. I like the idea that people are able to, like, come up with an imaginary thing and then develop it and build it all in their minds. And I'm impressed by that. In terms of what they actually hypothesized, Lovelace is as important as Babbage. There's no doubt in my mind. Babbage did hardware. Lovelace did software. Babbage figured out how to make a thing. Lovelace figured out what you could do with it. Mm-hmm. In this work, she invented loops and nested loops in programming. She talked about a hypothetical thing that could have taken 330 cards, but then instead figured out how to do it with only 3 cards. She dreamed about what computers could do beyond numbers and hypothesized writing music on them. She wrote that, quote, the fundamental relations of pitch, sound, and the science of harmony could be used in order to, quote, compose elaborate and scientific pieces of music of any degree of complexity or extent. She also predicted, I think accurately, that computers will never be able to think, that AI itself is sort of an illusion. She wrote, quote, the analytical engine has no pretensions to originate anything. It can do whatever we know how to in order to perform. And essentially later, the way that Babbage comes back into fame is that Alan Turing finds Ada's writing. And famously, I don't remember what episode we covered him on, but he was a persecuted for homosexuality inventor of computers who also defeated the Nazis, Alan Turing, that guy. Okay, again, the annoying thing on Twitter where right-wing people are like, now I see all the right-wing shit on Twitter ever since Elon Musk took over engagement bait or whatever. But there's this thing where it's like, well, no one from this country's flag ever invented anything. And it's like the trans-inclusive rainbow flag. And it's like, Alan Turing beat the Nazis.
Yeah.
There's a lot of other stuff.
No big deal.
Yeah. You're talking about 40% of the human population is roughly LGBT by old studies from 100 years ago. Like, I have a feeling people did some shit.
People did some shit. And I gotta say, that quote mm-hmm. that you just read from Lovelace about mm-hmm. how computers would only ever be like regurgitating what we know.
Yeah.
I cannot believe that that was not written this year about AI, because it is so fucking spot on. And it is wild to hear how prescient that was all the way back then.
Yeah, when computers were literally a figment of her and Babbage's imagination.
That is like some mind-blowing shit right there.
Yeah, because the actual crazy magic is what the human mind can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so Alan Turing called this objection Lovelace's objection. And it's like still stands as like a thing in modern computer science or whatever. She was the force that almost brought us the computer age 100 years early, because she basically hounded Babbage into letting her take over, not building, but like project managing the building thereof. And I think her husband was going to have to be a proxy in order to like make this happen or whatever. But I read one version where it was basically like Babbage was the CTO and she was going to be the CEO, you know? And this is not the kind of thing you can build in your garage. The analytical engine would have been the size of a freight train, or maybe the size of an engine car. I am confused by the thing I read about it. It would have involved at least 50,000 moving parts, and it would have required government intervention to make it happen. They actually would have had to give more money. And basically she writes all these letters being like, hey, bud, let me take over. I can actually make this happen. I'm not a bitter old man who everyone's mad at, you know? And he eventually relents and he's like, okay, let's make this happen. And instead, she gets sick. She was never particularly healthy, but in her 30s, she got way sicker. It was cervical cancer, though she didn't know that for a while. And she's like taking a lot of medication, a lot of laudanum and other stuff for the pain. So instead of fundamentally changing the world, which she absolutely could have done, she died at 36, same age that her father died. While she was on her deathbed, she requested that Charles Dickens come to her bedside to read to her about death from one of his books. And she wrote about herself while she died. I begin to understand death, which is going on quietly and gradually every minute and will never be a thing of one particular moment. And she also, while on her deathbed, made a confession that upset her husband gravely. And we will never know what it was. And I'm so annoyed. My money's on cheating, but I'd rather it was my father, Lord Byron, is alive and he's a vampire and he's going to turn me into a vampire. Sorry, bud. She let her mother save her soul on her deathbed, because her mother's like writing her the same notes like, save today? You know, like, hey, how about today? You want Jesus today? And so she religiously converted back to Christianity from people like to try to own her for whatever their particular religion or lack of religion is. Scientific atheism. It also could be possible that she was a deist like her father or a pantheist. She wrote a lot about God as like, she seemed to be kind of on a like natural theology page somewhere between that and atheism. She talked about science was her religion, but not in a way where it was like, therefore I don't need religion. I think she like meant it. She was just interesting. And I have no idea if she accepted Christ in earnest or if it was to ease her mother's worries or she just did the like, isn't it that there's that logic puzzle of like, well, you might as well on your deathbed because there's no harm in not doing it or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like to think she did it for her mom. I mean, whatever. Like, but it like it's like a nice like, oh, I don't want you to worry about my soul or whatever. You know, I don't know. But she insisted she be buried next to her father. This was the fact that made me then deep dive Lord Byron. I was just doing mostly Ada and a little bit of Charles. And I was like, man, she was raised to have nothing to do with her father. And she was like, I'm getting buried next to my father. Her memorial was engraved with a sonnet that she wrote called The Rainbow, which is about how despite the miseries and mourning of the world, God gives us rainbows so that we can be soothed. It's actually very sweet. I actually like it more than I like Lord Byron's poetry that I've read. But I've only read a little bit of Lord Byron's poetry. Neither her mother nor Babbage came to her funeral. I am not sure why, especially her mother. It might have been an objection to the location. And the obituaries about her from the time are just discussing, now I know she seemed really masculine, but don't worry. She was still feminine at heart. She liked music like a proper woman, even though she did all that man stuff.
How embarrassing that she did so much and that that's what her obituary was concerned with. Did she adhere to traditional gender roles? Don't worry, y'all. She totally did.
Yeah. God damn it. She had three kids. Her oldest son and her did not get along. He fucked off to the Navy, deserted, and died working in a shipyard at 26. Her daughter married a poet and moved to Southwest Asia and became the world's premier breeder of Arabian horses. Her youngest son inherited the title and stayed on the estate and like was really not into his parents, but was into his grandma, like Lady Byron, and wrote books talking shit about his grandfather, Lord Byron. Babbage lived for another 18 years, never quite making progress on his analytical machine, just writing a bunch of different shit. He went to war against the street musicians, cranky old man. And the pair were largely forgotten for a long time. But eventually there were mechanical computers, then electromechanical, then electronic. In 1940s, people started programming. Alan Turing rediscovered the pair through Ada and her translation and notes, and heavily influenced him, specifically as he was developing the idea of a universal computer instead of the task-specific computers that were being developed already. So in the end, I would say yes, they influenced modern computing incredibly indirectly, even though there's this like skip where they weren't for a minute, you know? And the part that makes me sad, there's a lot of things that make me sad. A lot of things make me very happy. The thing that makes me sad is thinking about how it's probably good that the British didn't develop the computer during the peak of their empire. I want to be happy about cool machines. When you add the willingness to treat people as numbers to one of the largest and worst empires the world has ever suffered under. Alan Turing's Lady Lovelace's objection is, quote, an AI can't originate anything. That's the simplification of that. I think about that constantly now. Which is like, and what's cool about that is it's like, it's not even a therefore don't do it.
Right.
You know?
I think I completely agree. And it's like, it's not a therefore don't do it, but it's an understand this at a fundamental level as you use it. And I think that's what sort of gets mixed up. It's so easy for people to think about AI as like hyper-aware computer brains that are learning things. And it is just spitting back out at us things that we do and know and the biases that we have. And so just understand it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same as, I mean, the analytical machine, I'm sure, seemed like magic, you know? And so Lovelace was sitting there being like, it's not magic. It's a machine. And it's, I think she'd be doing the exact same thing right now if she was alive, you know? I think she'd probably be pushing AI and being like, it doesn't create things. And it's annoying because AI to me is like a perfect example of this. Like, the reason it seems bad is there's a lot of reasons, but it's because of the economic system we live in, because of the systems of control that we live under, you know? I don't know. In the 1980s, the U.S. Department of Defense named its programming language Ada. Apparently, it's still sometimes used, but apparently it wasn't a particularly successful programming language. This stuff gets beyond me. I don't know as much about all of this. In 2002, people built a difference engine based on Babbage's notes, and only a single correction was necessary to make it work. No one has yet built his analytical engine, so no one knows if it works. And that's Ada Lovelace, child of vampire who invented programming.
Yeah, if you would have told me that when we started this conversation, you were going to start with vampires and effectively loop back around to computers, I wouldn't have believed you. But yeah. Killjoy, you've done it again.
Hell yeah. I spent so much money on red yarn.
Yeah, your house must just be like connections between things that seem so... Someone's going to come into your house one day and be like, is she okay? Like, what's going on with Margaret?
It happens already, but that's mostly because of my decor. A lot of it is very medieval.
Aren't you so glad? I really, your statement about, I'm really glad this wasn't created during this time. I think about that so often. I'm like, what if like a motherfucker like Oswald Mosley had like an algorithm computer? Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. It's such a, it makes me so sad. I want us to just, it's like Elon Musk makes Mars seem not cool. How hard do you have to work to make Mars seem not cool? Space is cool, and the reason it's sketchy is because of governments and stuff, but now it's even sketchier because, you know, people who are terrible want to go and...
How do you make outer space seem lame, Elon? What a
Elon Musk involved. That's all you got to do.
Invented a cyberpunk-looking truck and made it the worst thing that's ever happened to a car.
Have y'all ever seen one in the wild?
No.
Yes, dude, I did. I saw one.
Shit.
I did.
I think the first time one comes into West Virginia, all the rest of us in regular pickups are going to run it off the road.
Bridget, yeah,
the citizens will descend on it.
Yeah.
I saw one like 2 weeks ago, B. I did. It was wild.
What were your thoughts?
I was like, I'm programmed to hate this. I'm like, why is it shaped that way? What is happening?
I grew up on cyberpunk, and like, so the only time I saw one that looked right was someone had graffitied one.
Okay, and once it was like that,
I was like, oh, now it looks like it belongs in the cyberpunk dystopia I was promised. But yeah, instead it's like can't drive through a mud puddle.
Yeah, the only time I see them, it's not doing something cool and cyberpunky. It's like
valeting.
Yeah, or like getting rusted because it rained. Something decidedly not cool.
Yeah.
Ugh. Wow.
Well, if people want to know more about the culture of the internet and the ways in which it has both interesting and bad things, is there anywhere that they can do that?
Well,
Bridget?
I would turn them to my podcast, There Are No Girls on the Internet. Also, great transition, Margaret.
Thank you.
Snaps from Magpie.
It's my job's security. It's staying on top of this. Yeah, people should check that out. And if you want to check out more of my stuff, I write a Substack. I post every week. Half of the posts are free to everyone and are like more political and theoretical or historical or whatever, and like on these kind of subjects. The other half are more personal. And if you want to know more about my personal life, you have to pay me. And I feel fine about that. And that's what I have to plug. Sophie, you got anything? Like any new podcasts from Cool Zone Media people could check out?
Yeah, if you want one that's already out, check out Ed Zitron's podcast, Better Offline. It is a weekly tech podcast, part of the Cool Zone Media Network. And launching in May, we have a new weekly show called 16th Minute of Fame, hosted by Jamie Loftus. So look out for that one in early May.
All right. Well, go forth and listen to podcasts and then listen to this one next Monday because we'll be back.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.